Hello and welcome to this week's reading of The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media, all you need to know about everything that matters. I'm reading from the April 5th issue. First, we turn to The World at a Glance, from Moscow. Tajiks targeted after terror attack. The Kremlin has launched a nationwide crackdown on Central Asian immigrants following last week's mass shooting that killed at least 140 people at a Moscow concert hall. Four suspects from Tajikistan bearing signs of torture confessed to perpetrating the attack, and at least four other Central Asians were detained on suspicion of abetting them. Police raided migrant dormitories across Russia to interrogate and detain workers, and dozens of Central Asian travelers were held at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport for 2 days this week without food or water. "They've locked us up like criminals," one Kyrgyz traveler told Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. "The Tajiks are getting beaten up." Russia's economy relies on the cheap labor of more than 10.5 million, mostly Muslim guest workers, from the former Soviet republics of Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Anti-migrant sentiment has always been widespread, and it has surged since the concert hall shootings, with reports of mobs beating Central Asians and burning down their businesses. Tajikistan advised its citizens in Russia to stay home. Responsibility for the attack was claimed by the Afghan branch of ISIS, known as ISIS Khorasan or ISIS-K. A UN report out last year said that ISIS-K had begun aggressively recruiting in Tajikistan and the surrounding region, focusing on experienced Islamist militant groups with a history of terrorist attacks. It had also succeeded in winning the loyalty of top members of Jamaat Ansarullah, an ethnic Tajik Islamist group based in Afghanistan and known as the Tajik Taliban. "A handful of individuals has brought shame on an entire people," Nekruz, a Tajik taxi driver in St. Petersburg, told Eurasianet. "Now they look at us like we're cursed." A couple of items from Beijing. First, maternity ward shuttering. Hospitals across China are closing their labor and delivery wings because so few children are being born, the state-backed Daily Economic News reported last week. "An obstetric winter appears to be coming," the paper said. Multiple hospitals in at least three provinces announced obstetric department closures in just the past 2 months. China's population shrank for a second consecutive year due both to the low birth rate and a surge in COVID deaths. Though the country ended its one-child policy in 2016 and began offering financial and tax incentives in an effort to boost the birth rate, births have declined steadily since then, from 13.6 per 1,000 people in 2016 to just 6.4 last year. Also from Beijing, cyber hack allegations. China accused the U.S. and the United Kingdom of, quote, malicious slander, end quote, this week, after both countries imposed sanctions on it for cyber hacking. Washington said Beijing's spy agency has been placing malware for years in U.S. critical infrastructure, including defense systems and electrical grids that could be activated to distract the U.S. in the event China invaded Taiwan. London, for its part, said the Chinese had stolen the voter roll information of 40 million British citizens. The sanctions target the Wuhan Shaanxi Science and Technology Company, which the U.S. says is a front company for the Ministry of State Security. Separately, the U.S. Department of Justice indicated that seven Chinese citizens it said were hackers with the APT-31 group, which has sent more than 10,000 malware-laced emails to targets including White House officials and U.S. senators. Moving to Tel Aviv, rift with U.S. widens. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a high-level delegation to Washington this week after the U.S. allowed a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza to pass. It was the first time the U.S. had failed to veto such a resolution, but officials had alerted Israel ahead of time and were surprised by the drastic reaction. Israeli officials were supposed to meet with White House officials to discuss Israel's planned incursion into Rafah, where about 1 million Palestinians are sheltering. The Biden administration has repeatedly warned against such a military operation. Netanyahu has just as doggedly insisted it will proceed. Last week, when Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Tel Aviv to appeal to Netanyahu personally, Israel announced its largest land seizure in the West Bank since 1993, a move seen as a calculated sign of disrespect. From Dublin, first millennial leader. Simon Harris, 37, is set to become Ireland's youngest ever prime minister after the governing centre-right Fine Gael party named him its leader this week. Harris, who did his first community organizing at 15 and dropped out of college at 19 after winning a local council election, is known for his TikTok savvy and his oratory skills. Currently the Minister for Higher Education, he was the only person to run for the leadership when Leo Varadkar abruptly resigned as Prime Minister last week following a failed referendum to change the Irish Constitution. Varadkar, who was 38 when he became a towel search in 2017, cited personal and political, but mainly political, reasons for stepping down. Harris said he would use a can-do approach to re-energize the party, saying, "You ain't seen nothing yet." From Caracas, candidates barred. Venezuelan put a deal with the U.S. at risk this week by blocking the opposition from fielding its chosen candidate in the July presidential election. The opposition Unitary Platform, PUD, first nominated Maria Corina Machado, former lawmaker who polls said would beat President Nicolas Maduro in a fair vote, but the regime barred her from running in January. The PUD picked a replacement candidate, but was unable to access the election site within a brief registration window this week. Now the government has allowed it to register only an unnamed, quote, candidate number 13, end quote. Last October, the U.S. loosened oil sanctions against Venezuela in exchange for a pledge from Maduro to hold free and fair, quote unquote, elections. But the sanctions could be restored soon. Machado said, "They're not elections if the regime chooses the candidates." Next, we'll move to some sample editorials. First, High Court poised to maintain wide access to abortion pill. What happened? The Supreme Court this week signaled that it was likely to reject a challenge to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is now used in 63% of terminations and has become the latest battleground in the fight over reproductive rights. The plaintiffs in FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, represented by Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley's wife, Erin Hawley, sought to roll back expansions to mifepristone access that the Food and Drug Administration passed in 2016 and 2021. The group of anti-abortion doctors claimed they'll suffer harm through having to treat women who come to hospitals with complications from the pill. But there's been no increase in complications since 2016. And doctors who object can opt out under federal conscience protections. Justices questioned whether the hypothetical complaints gave the plaintiffs standing to sue. Originally approved in 2000 for use through 7 weeks of pregnancy, access to mifepristone was expanded to 10 weeks in 2016, and telehealth prescriptions and mail delivery were approved in 2021. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled last year that those changes should be rolled back, but the decision was paused until it could reach the Supreme Court. A ruling in favor of the alliance could curtail access by mail while having wide-ranging implications for the FDA's regulatory authority. But the Supreme Court appeared unwilling to take that step. This case seems like a prime example of turning what could be a small lawsuit into a nationwide legislative assembly on an FDA rule, said Justice Neil Gorsuch. What the columnist said. The job of judges isn't to serve as super FDA, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The plaintiffs don't have any standing because the harm they claim is quote-unquote speculative. Siding with them could set a dangerous precedent for fly-specking courts to start second-guessing FDA decisions, slowing access to all kinds of life-saving treatments. This case calls for judicial modesty, no matter your views on abortion. The expected ruling for the FDA must be a letdown for Democrats, said Noah Rothman in National Review. They were laying the rhetorical groundwork to link this decision to an Alabama court's recent ruling that embryos used in vitro fertilization are children, thinking that more attacks on reproductive rights could lead to electoral victories. But after the fallout from overturning Roe v. Wade 2 years ago, this court seems reluctant to set off another abortion politics bomb. This was a case of built of vapors, said Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern in Slate. It was so weak that two justices empathetic to the plaintiffs, Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, had to resort to the 1873 Comstock Act to justify their positions. That law outlaws shipping contraceptives by mail hasn't been used in over a century. Yet Alito scolded the FDA for allowing mifepristone to be mailed, teeing up future efforts to use that archaic law to block abortions. Whenever a door closes on the worst MAGA toxins at this court, an Overton window opens to something so much worse. Also from the sample editorial section, Trump rages as hush money trial goes ahead. What happened? Donald Trump scored a victory in a Manhattan courtroom this week as an appeals court slashed the size of potentially crippling bond payment, but an hour later took a blow in a second courtroom as a judge ruled that the first of four pending criminal cases against him will start trial April 15th. Trump faced a deadline to either pay a $464 million verdict against him in a civil fraud trial, which he was found to have massively overinflated the value of his properties, or post a $454 million bond while appealing. Trump's lawyers said he couldn't secure a bond so large, and New York Attorney General Letitia James signaled that if he failed, she'd start seizing his real estate holdings. Trump was thrown a lifeline when the appeals court reduced the bond to $175 million, gave him 10 more days to post it. "We'll put it up very quickly and we'll win the case," Trump said. He scored another coup when his Truth Social platform went public and its valuation rose to $7.8 billion, though he can't sell or borrow against his 58% stake in the company for at least 6 months. In the second case, New York Judge Juan Marchand denied Trump's bid to delay a trial on charges he falsified business records to cover up a hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels before the 2016 election. Marchand later imposed a limited gag order, barring Trump from discussing witnesses and others involved in the case. On social media, Trump called Marchand, quote, a hater, end quote, who suffers from Trump derangement syndrome, and took aim at his daughter, Democratic political consultant. How can this be allowed? Trump wrote. What the editorial said. The bond reduction is the fair and correct outcome, said the Washington Post. Whatever one thinks of Trump, every defendant deserves due process, including the right to an appeal. Even billionaires can't easily cough up hundreds of millions in cash, and if James seized his assets and the appeals court later overturned the penalty, the damage would be irreversible. Trump may ultimately have to pay up in full, but in the meantime, allowing him to exhaust his legal options without pushing him toward bankruptcy is only just. It's deliciously appropriate that Trump, a serial tax grifter, will see his Stormy Daniels trial start on Tax Day, said New York Daily News. As well as allegedly violating New York tax laws in that case with his sleazy payout, he's also accused of breaking state and federal campaign laws. But at its core, this trial is about whether the man who was once the most powerful in the world, and may yet be again, can be held to the same standard of justice as an ordinary New Yorker. The next segment from The Week magazine, Best Columns. First, from India, sparring with China high in the Himalayas. China is picking a pointless fight with India, said Shashir Gupta in the Hindustan Times of India, lashed out last week after India inaugurated a new highway tunnel 13,000 feet up in the Himalayas that links the northeastern states of Assam and Arunachal Pradesh near the disputed border with China. China repeated its unfounded cartographical claims, first levied during British colonial rule over India, that Arunachal Pradesh should properly be considered South Tibet, and therefore Chinese territory. We require the Indian side to cease any action that may complicate the bordery question, China's defense ministry said, adding menacingly that the Chinese military would, quote, resolutely defend national sovereignty, end quote. But this is just bluster. China has gone downhill in recent years with a real estate crisis and high youth unemployment, so it's trying to distract people by scent-marking its territorial claims. India won't take the bait. China may complain, but India will keep building whatever we want on our own land. Yet the Sella Tunnel isn't just another infrastructure project, said Marusha Mustafa in The Independent from the United Kingdom, cutting a path deep underneath the Himalayas. It will allow India to move troops around near the largely ill-defined 2,100-mile border without China seeing. India and China fought a war over this long-standing boundary dispute in 1962, when China briefly occupied Arunachal Pradesh before withdrawing its forces back to what both sides call the line of actual control. Now, both countries are nuclear powers, and the issue is no closer to being settled. The conflict flared up again in 2020, when skirmishes further west in the Himalayas killed at least 20 Indian soldiers and 4 Chinese. Since then, to fortify India's stance, India Prime Minister Narendra Modi has gone on a building spree, constructing bridges, tunnels, and airfields near the border. China, meanwhile, has built model villages near the border and altered its rules on troop movements in the area. The timing of the tunnel's unveiling is suspicious, said the Global Times of China in an editorial. Modi is running for re-election later this month, and he may be deliberately stoking conflict at the border to rally Indians around the flag. But using border and security issues as a magic weapon to gain votes and popularity is like dancing on the edge of a knife. Modi is risking serious consequences that could endanger the peace of the entire region and cause immeasurable losses to India. Modi should also beware accepting U.S. support in this matter, said Zhang Xiaozhang in China Daily from China. Washington rashly waded into the dispute last week with a State Department statement reiterating U.S. recognition of so-called Arunachal Pradesh as Indian territory. The U.S. has been wooing Modi for years, trying to lure India into its anti-China alliance. By weighing in on the border, Washington believes it can drive a wedge between China and India, but it could prove costly for India to accept that wedge. China's economy is 5 times bigger than India's, and we have the world's largest military. Does India really want to offend a giant neighbor? Well, all the support it gets from the distant quote-unquote supporter is a statement. Next, the best column from Mexico. Texas can't kick out all its migrants, by Israel Lopez Gutierrez, El Heraldo de Mexico. Blinded by his own xenophobia, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has overplayed his hand, said Israel Lopez Gutierrez. Abbott's defining trait is his blatant rejection of Mexicans and Mexico. He's the one who insisted on putting razor wire along the border between Texas and Mexico, which is supposed to be policed not by him, but by federal agents. Now he's come up with a new state law, SB4, that would let state police arrest and deport the undocumented. SB4 is currently on hold, pending judicial review, and if it does go into effect, it would cause an immediate rift with Mexico. But it would also be a catastrophe for Texas. The state is 40% Hispanic. Will it check papers on all those people? Both the Texas and U.S. economies depend on immigrants, including undocumented ones. The Congressional Budget Office says these workers will contribute $7 trillion to the U.S. economy in the next decade. Look, these are campaign times. And Abbott is clearly giddy at having recently been floated as Donald Trump's possible running mate. Talking about kicking migrants out plays well, but even if Trump wins the election, he won't shoot himself in the foot by doing without that powerful immigrant workforce. Abbott's plan is doomed. In a bit of a companion best column from Italy, paying off Egypt won't stop migrants, by Fabio Menetti, Il Fatto Quotidiano. Italy's president is trying to spin an EU aid package for Egypt as a solution for the migrant crisis, said Fabio Menetti, but it's something much grubbier. Last week, the EU extended to Egypt, a notorious violator of human rights, $8 billion to prop up its collapsing economy, of which a mere $217 million is earmarked to secure the borders. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, one of the deal's architects, trumpeted it as an historic migration deal, saying Italy's plan for Africa states is being implemented. That plan involves paying African countries to police their coastlines to prevent boatloads of asylum seekers from crossing the Mediterranean. The EU has already tried this with Libya and Tunisia, though it hasn't made a dent in the crossings. Worse, to give the appearance of holding up its end of the bargain, Tunisia has taken to deporting thousands of sub-Saharan migrants and abandoning them in the desert. Adding Egypt to the sorry project will be useless at best. Few migrants depart from Egypt anyway, and a human rights catastrophe at worst. The truth is, the EU-Egypt deal may be useful for Brussels, which wants more influence in the Middle East, and for Italy, which is always seeking new routes for gas. But let's not try to pass it off as a way to stop migrants. And a best column from the United Kingdom, Why You Can't Say Widow Now, by Celia Walden, The Telegraph. The woke generation is more fragile than we knew, said Celia Walden. Not only do they faint at any word that carries a whiff of unpleasantness, but they can also even find fault with adorable fluffy guinea pigs. In the new, quote, inclusive language, end quote, guide that Lloyd's Bank has just issued for its 57,000 employees, guinea pig is listed as a term to be avoided, because vegan colleagues may be offended by a reference to animal experimentation. Headless chicken also can't be used, because it invokes violence, while sold down the river is a term from the American slave trade. The most baffling of the banned words is widow. Lloyds calls it, quote, unnecessarily vivid, end quote, says it could spur memories of traumatic loss. How should staff now refer to this unlucky breed of women, you may well ask? Lloyd suggests separated, a word that means something entirely different and is guaranteed to generate sitcom-worthy misunderstandings. Is Scottish Widows, the venerable life insurance firm owned by Lloyd's, now to be renamed Scottish Separatists? The whole usage guide essentially invites us to imagine a cowardly new world without pain, hardship, or loss, yet we need the bad to appreciate the good. Living in a sanitized world where any form of extreme emotion is dampened down to nothing, now that would be traumatic. Next, we'll move to the health and science section. Milestone transplant uses pig kidney. A pig kidney has been successfully transplanted into a human for the first time, a breakthrough that could offer hope to thousands of Americans suffering kidney failure. Surgeons at Massachusetts General Hospital attached the kidney from a genetically modified pig in a four-hour operation last week. The patient, Richard Slayman, 62, shows no sign so far of rejecting the organ, and his new kidney began producing urine shortly after the surgery. He has been on dialysis for 7 years before receiving a donor kidney in 2018, but that organ failed last year, so he qualified for the experimental transplant. Placing animal organs in humans is extremely risky. In the two cases of pig-to-human heart transplants that have been carried out in the U.S., the patients died within 2 months. For this procedure, the pig's genes were edited to inactivate retroviruses, and some human genes were inserted into the kidney. It really is a groundbreaking milestone. Winfred William, Associated Chief of Nephrology at Massachusetts General, told NBCNews.com, "Should the kidney continue to work well and this is a success, I think it represents a breakthrough in a number of different areas. Even if the kidney doesn't work for very long, the technique could still be useful to tide a patient over for some months or years until a human kidney becomes available for transplant. Some 90,000 Americans are currently on kidney transplant waiting lists." Also from the health and science section, vaping alters your DNA. Vape users suffer the same sort of changes in their DNA as smokers who go on to develop cancer, a new study has found. Scientists at University College London compared samples of cheek cells from people who used e-cigarettes with those from cigarette smokers. They found that the cells had been substantially altered through a process known as epigenetics, in which environmental and lifestyle factors transform the way our DNA is expressed. In this case, the alterations are thought to enable cells to divide more quickly, thus potentially develop into tumors. The same changes were seen in the cancerous tissues of smokers with lung cancer. The study, which involved 4,000 people, doesn't prove that vaping causes cancer, but it is the first major research to show a link between the two. While the scientific consensus is that e-cigarettes are safer than smoking tobacco, lead author Shara Herzog tells The Times of the UK, we cannot assume they're completely safe to use, and it is important to explore the potential long-term risks. Nearly 6% of American adults vape, compared with about 11.5% who smoke. Among high schoolers, the trend is reversed. Some 10% vape, and just 2% smoke. Teen pregnancy, early death. Women who get pregnant in their teens are more likely to die prematurely in the next few decades. That's the conclusion of a new study of around 2.2 million teenagers in Ontario, Canada, reports the New York Times. Even after accounting for income, education, and pre-existing health problems, the researchers found that those who had given birth in their teens were twice as likely to die before their 31st birthday than those who hadn't. And it wasn't just live births. The odds were similar for women who, as teenagers, had ectopic pregnancies, stillbirths, or miscarriages, while those who had a teenage abortion saw a 40% increased risk of death. Further, the younger the person was when they became pregnant, said lead author Joel Ray from St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, the greater the risk was of premature death. Yet the most common cause of the early deaths was not health-related, but rather injury, whether self-inflicted or at the hands of others. That suggests that teen pregnancy is a proxy for other influences, such as traumatic childhood experiences, rather than a causal factor. Finally, from the health and science section, insulin from a cow. A cow has been genetically modified to produce human insulin in its milk, a potential breakthrough for the 8.4 million Americans who rely on the hormone for their diabetes treatment. Researchers inserted a targeted segment of human DNA into a bovine embryo in Brazil. When the resulting calf grew up, and after efforts to impregnate her through artificial insemination failed, they used hormones to trigger her body into producing milk. The team's hope was that the milk would contain proinsulin, a hormone precursor, which they could purify. To their surprise, the cow basically did the processing herself, producing both proinsulin and insulin. Researchers don't know how much of the hormone a typical lactation cycle would produce, but a unit of insulin is just 0.0347 milligrams, so even if a cow produces just 1 gram per liter of milk, she would generate an enormous supply. I could see a future where a 100-head herd, equivalent to a small Illinois or Wisconsin dairy, could produce all the insulin needed for the country, study leader Matthew Wheeler from the University of Illinois tells Health Day. Next, we'll move to the business section. Boeing, CEO to step down as woes mount. Boeing's series of disasters is forcing a change in leadership, said Sharon Turlip in the Wall Street Journal. Mired in crisis over quality of its planes, the company announced this week that Chief Executive Dave Calhoun will leave at the end of the year. The head of its commercial aircraft business, Stanley Deal, will also step down. And Board Chairman Larry Kellner won't stand for re-election. Calhoun took over while Boeing was grounded following the fatal crashes of two 737 MAX planes in 2018 and 2019, but he's been in the hot seat since a door plug blew out of an Alaska Airlines flight in January. It's gotten so bad that a group of airline CEOs recently requested meetings with Boeing's board, an unusual move showing their dissatisfaction with the company and Calhoun. The end of the year is still way too much time to leave an already reeling company in limbo, said Thomas Black in Bloomberg. Boeing can't afford a drawn-out transition. It would also benefit from a new CEO with experience turning around a troubled company. One name already getting investors' attention is Larry Culp, who deserves to be heralded for rescuing General Electric. Another dark horse candidate is Dave Cote, who turned around Honeywell. But when asked if he'd be willing to run Boeing, Cote replied succinctly in an email, "Nope." Can you blame him? Also from the business section, windfalls. Truth Social IPO gives Trump a new fortune. Donald Trump's media company experienced a significant pop on its first day of public trading, said Dan Mangan in CNBC.com. Shares of Trump Media and Technology Group jumped more than 50% minutes after it made its debut under the ticker DJT this week. Successful showing gave the company, which has one business, the social media platform Truth Social, a $7.8 billion market value, raised Trump's net worth to more than $6 billion. Trump Media's plans to go public via merger with a special purpose acquisition company were first announced in 2021, but were delayed by a grand jury investigation. Pharma. Medicare will provide some Wegovy coverage. Medicare will cover Wegovy for patients at risk of heart disease, said Berkeley Lovelace Jr. in NBCNews.com. The decision announced this week could grant billions of patients access to the popular yet expensive weight loss medication that's competitive to Ozempic. But the drug can be prescribed only to people who are overweight or have obesity to reduce their risk of heart disease in order for Medicare to cover it. Wegovy's developer, Novo Nordisk, also said this week it's buying Cardior Pharmaceuticals, which specializes in heart disease treatments. Some items from the bottom line column in the business section. Sales of existing homes surged 9.5% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.38 million in February, the National Association of Realtors said. It's the first time in more than 2 years that sales have increased for two consecutive months. Homes that sold for more than $1 billion shot up 37% compared with the same month a year ago. This from Wall Street Journal. Last year, 120,000 high-net-worth individuals, those who have over $1 billion of liquid investable assets, moved to a different country, according to Henley & Partners. Australia was number one destination for the uber-rich, with a net inflow of 5,200 millionaires, ahead of the United Arab Emirates, 4,500, and Singapore, 3,200, from Oz.com. WeWork's co-founder and ex-CEO Adam Neumann and several partners submitted a $500 million bid to buy the troubled office-sharing firm out of bankruptcy. WeWork's 2019 peak valuation was $47 billion, from Bloomberg. State Farm will discontinue coverage for 72,000 houses and apartments in California starting this summer. The company last year stopped issuing new policies in the state, citing soaring costs, regulations, and the increasing risk of catastrophes like wildfires. CBSNews.com. A report from Lixil Americas, maker of bathroom fixtures, estimates the U.S. will be short about 550,000 licensed plumbers by the year 2027. Lixil also estimates the plumber shortage cost the economy about $33 billion in 2022, from Bloomberg. Finally, from the bottom line column, almost 940,000 Americans have yet to claim their 2020 tax refund. That's more than $1 billion worth of unclaimed refunds that will be left on the table if people don't file their 2020 tax return before May 17th. From Axios. Next, we'll turn the page to the Making Money section. Real estate. The end of the 6% commission? The cartel-like scheme that kept home prices artificially high has finally been dismantled, said David Dayan in The American Prospect. For decades, the National Association of Realtors engineered a concealed form of price fixing in the American housing market. Powerful lobbying group required that any home listed for sale on its multiple listing service, MLS, include the commission rate that the seller would give the buyer. In practice, this locked sellers into paying the commission for both their agent and their buyer's agent and ensured that the commission stayed close to a fixed 6%. Nowhere else in the world did this take place. Everyone endured this for too long until a group of Missouri homeowners won a class action suit in October. The NAR decided to settle, along with paying $418 million in damages, agreed to eliminate its quote-unquote extortionate commissions rule. "What a great way to kick off the spring buying season," said Brooke Masters in the Financial Times. Though the revised rules don't officially take hold until summer, these much-needed changes should cut costs for everyone. Home sellers will keep more of the sales proceeds. Buyers can save money by foregoing the use of an agent at all, looking for houses online. Meanwhile, mortgage rates have dropped below 7%, and things are finally looking up for the U.S. housing market. Biggest downside of fixing the system is that it will likely push a lot of realtors out of business, said Peter Coy in the New York Times. It's going to get a lot more competitive for them to earn commissions, which right now add up to about $100 billion a year. Buyers and sellers can rejoice. As for agents, I hope they find other work. "Don't be so sure that this changes many things," said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. "The settlement notably doesn't bar seller agents from advertising buyer broker commissions on other home selling platforms besides the MLS, nor does it forbid buyer brokers from steering clients away from homes that don't offer them a fat commission rate." Justice Department viewed the settlement suspiciously, saying it makes cosmetic changes that don't necessarily end collusion. In fact, there's a possibility that the Department of Justice decides this settlement doesn't go far enough and will want more changes, said James Rodriguez in Business Insider. "Many people seem to think this will make housing prices drop, but sellers still have the upper hand in most parts of the country, and it's hard to imagine sellers giving buyers a break because they're saving 3% on the sales commission." Also from the Making Money section, Mexican timeshare scams. The Mexican drug cartel has been targeting American seniors through their timeshares, said Maria Abi Habib in New York Times. The simple scheme, perpetrated by the murderous cartel Jalisco New Generation, starts with employees posing as sales representatives, calling up timeshare owners, offering to buy their investments back for generous sums. They also demand upfront fees for anything from listing advertisements to paying government fines. The representatives have been able to persuade their victims to wire large amounts of money to Mexico, sometimes as much as hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then they disappear. The cartel has also bribed employees at Mexican resorts at Puerto Vallarta to leak guest information for targets. Overall, timeshare fraud complaints have risen 79% in the past 4 years, according to the FBI. 5 decades of rising home prices. U.S. home prices have risen 2.4 times faster than inflation since 1963, said Anna Teresa Sola in CNBC.com. If home prices increased at the same rate as inflation over the past 60 years, the median price of a typical house would be $177,511, according to real estate data company Cleaver. In reality, the cost of a typical home is closer to $500,000. Mortgage rates play a role in housing costs, but another big factor is the decrease in the supply of new homes. More than half, 53.2% of people surveyed, say housing affordability will impact their voting plans this election, and 64.2% of owners and renters have negative feelings about the economy because of the housing market. Finally, from the Making Money section, surveillance in the privacy booth. Your office privacy booth may be getting a lot less private, said Matthew Boyle in Bloomberg. Framery, one of the world's biggest sellers of office work pods, claims it has found a way to embed sensors in the booth's seats to track the vital signs, heart and breathing rates, of those in it. The sensors capture blood pumping through vessels in the buttocks, and an algorithm can automatically convert and analyze those pulse readings. The purpose, Framery says, is to detect if employees, quote, are getting frazzled or agitated at work. Though Framery says that the data is anonymized and does not drill down to individuals, privacy experts say there's no guarantee that Framery's clients won't try to do exactly that. Our next segment, Talking Points. NBC, why it hired and fired McDaniel. NBC News's bold new Hire a Liar initiative didn't last long, said Jennifer Brooks in Minneapolis Star Tribune. Faced with a massive revolt by on-air talent, the network this week axed former Republican National Committee Chair Rona McDaniel as a paid contributor, just days after signing her on a $300,000-a-year deal. NBC journalists were understandably outraged by the prospect of sharing a platform with an election denier who tore at the fabric of our democracy on the say-so of former President Donald Trump. On Meet the Press, the normally unflappable Chuck Todd blasted McDaniel, who once said NBC was a home for, quote, prime-time propagandists for credibility issues and for subjecting the network journalists to character assassination. On sister network MSNBC, Morning Joe co-hosts Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski vowed that McDaniel would never appear on their show, while Rachel Maddow likened her hiring to inviting a mobster to work at a DA's office. Oh, spare us the sanctimony, said Jeffrey Blahar in National Review. I don't recall the outrage when Jen Psaki went directly from being President Biden's press secretary to an NBC contributor, or when George Stephanopoulos, once a gleefully vicious hatchet man for President Bill Clinton, jumped to ABC. The only difference between those party hacks and McDaniel is that she's a Republican. Problem isn't McDaniel's party ID, said Lauren Stiller Ricklin in The Bulwark. It's her utter contempt for the truth. She gleefully pushed Trump's voter fraud claims, personally tried to halt the certification of Biden's 2020 election win in Michigan, and sought to rebrand the January 6th Capitol riot as, quote, legitimate political discourse, end quote. In her first interview as paid contributor on Meet the Press, McDaniel admitted she'd never really believed that Biden cheated in 2020, and that her rigging claims were just her taking, quote, one for the whole team, end quote. Clearly, McDaniel cannot be trusted to comment on future elections. This is a devilish moment for news organizations, said David Graham in The Atlantic. Outlets that aim to understand Trump and the MAGA movement want to find voices that represent them. NBC hoped that McDaniel would fill that void, even though she was ousted from the RNC by Trump. But finding former insiders who still have links to Trump World, whose hiring wouldn't outrage liberal viewers or journalists, and who can speak with intellectual honesty, is exceedingly difficult, if not inherently impossible. The McDaniel mess shows NBC hasn't solved the puzzle yet. Some items from the Noted column in Talking Points. E-commerce firms generated 3.4 billion pounds of plastic waste worldwide in 2021, estimated 709 million pounds of which came from Amazon. While the retail giant says much of its packaging can be recycled, less than 5% of plastic packaging returned by customers to Amazon ends up at a recycling facility, according to an investigation by the nonprofit U.S. Public Interest Research Group from the Los Angeles Times. After 2 years of decline, average life expectancy in the U.S. rose by more than a year in 2022 to 77.5. Two new CDC studies suggest the bump was largely a result of fewer COVID deaths, but life expectancy remains lower than before the pandemic, and a record 108,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2022, about 1,200 more than in 2021, from NPR.org. The U.S. will need the equivalent of about 34 new nuclear plants to meet rising demand for electricity over the next 5 years. The growing number of power-hungry computer data centers is driving the surge, which comes after 3 decades of falling or flat demand for electricity, from The Guardian. Finally, from the noted column, the United Nations has delivered more than $2.9 billion in cash to Afghanistan since the Taliban took control in 2021, according to a new Pentagon report. Most of the money that's going in cash through the UN is ultimately coming from U.S. taxpayers, said John Sopko, U.S. Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. It's going to a terrorist group, from ProPublica. Next, we'll move to the People segment. Esmond's stand-up days with Richard Lewis. Susie Esmond is mourning her old friend Richard Lewis, said Emma Alpern in Vulture.com. Esmond worked for 24 years with the notoriously idiosyncratic comic on Curb Your Enthusiasm, on which she played the hilariously rageful Susie Grain. But their friendship extended offset. They once did a stand-up comedy tour together, which was insane. Insane, says Esmond, 68. She would go on first. He wouldn't even go into the room until I said, "Good night, ladies and gentlemen," and walked out. He would wait in the car outside. Before and after the show, there would be so many messages from him, so many emails. It was the most neurotic behavior. After one show in Boston, Esmond had dinner at Hotel Bar with her husband. When I went up to the room, there was a 45-minute message on the hotel machine. I'm not exaggerating. Just on and on, these tangents. If that sounds annoying, it wasn't, said Esmond. He was incredibly sweet and lovable. These people like Richard and Bob Einstein and Gilbert Gottfried, they were such unique voices. They can't be replaced. Esmond is also feeling sentimental about saying farewell to Curb, now in its final season. We've all been together for a long time, she said. We've watched marriages and divorces and kids being born. It's been a full life. Also from the People segment, from death row to art world acclaim. Gary Tyler has pulled beauty from brutality, said Adela Benrar and The Guardian. At age 65, Los Angeles artist and youth worker is drawing acclaim for intricately quilted tapestries, a skill he learned while wrongfully imprisoned for 41 years in Louisiana's notoriously harsh Angola State Penitentiary. His subject matter, Black Men Behind Bars, African Warriors, is the, quote, manifestation of my past and present life, he said. It's something I never thought would catch the eye of so many people. Tyler was 17 when he was wrongfully convicted of the murder of a 13-year-old white boy by an all-white jury and sentenced to death. His sentence was reduced to life a year later. In Angola, he took up sewing as part of an initiative to raise money for the prison drama club by selling traditional quilts. Apprehensive at first, I mean, we're in a men's prison, he laughs. He was soon drawn in by the art form. Tyler continued his needle work after being freed in 2016, and in 2023 staged his first solo show at a Detroit gallery. Last month, he was awarded a booth at L.A.'s prestigious Frieze Art Fair and the prize recognizing artists with social impact. Growing recognition has shown he can reflect my past into something good, Tyler says. I want to be able to inspire. There are good things that can come out of prison. Finally, in the People segment, Federer's contented retirement. Roger Federer is just fine being done with tennis, said Zach Barron in GQ. After playing more than 1,500 pro matches over 24 years, the 20-time Grand Slam winner retired from competition in 2022, in part because of an injured knee that required multiple surgeries. I could feel the end coming closer, says Federer, 42. So when you're retired officially, you take a deep breath and you're like, wow, okay, that was good. I feel really at peace. He hasn't entirely left the sport behind. I just booked a court with my wife for the first time in my life. We went to play next to my kids, who were having a lesson. And it was so much fun. I always thought, how is the moment going to be when I go back on a court and actually don't have to improve? With his kids, two sets of twins, 9 and 14, I've told them I'm not the coach. Sometimes I can't control myself. I come in and go like, let me just quickly teach a little fundamental thing. He had a similar urge recently when watching his agent's son play with tennis team at Stanford University. Federer grabbed a racket to demonstrate different ways to hit a forehand. Every one I hit was perfect, and I'm just thinking, my God, it's still there. A brief item from the Poll Watch column. 100% of Republicans who consume Fox News and other conservative media intend to support Donald Trump in November, compared with 79% of Republicans who get information primarily from CNN and other mainstream media. Also from Poll Watch, 21% of Americans attend religious services every week, 9% attend almost every week, 56% seldom or never attend. And finally, let's wrap up with some wit and wisdom. Markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent, economist Gary Shilling quoted in Morningstar, the United Kingdom. How far fewer words we need to tell our stories than we imagine we do. Joyce Carol Oates quoted in the Harvard Crimson. Getting divorced just because you don't love a man is almost as silly as getting married just because you do. Zsa Gabor quoted in The Conversation. Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. Baseball manager Frank Robinson quoted in Forbes. Beauty and the devil are the same thing. Robert Malthorpe quoted in Lux Verity. I think that writing is very difficult, but so is any job carefully executed. What is a privilege, however, is to do a job to your own satisfaction. Gabriel Garcia Marquez quoted in the Shanghai Daily from China. And finally, race is the child of racism, not the father. Ta-Nehisi Coates quoted in Current Affairs. And that's all we have time for today. I've been reading from the April 5th installment of The Week magazine. We thank you for listening. So long until next time.